Ladies and gentlemen, coming back at your face once again, it is Hey Kids Comics. Long struggle to get this one for you, but we're doing it. We're coming strong, putting the flavor in your ear. I am, as always, your host, Andrew Farmer. With me, co-host
always.
I'm always Andrew Farmer, regardless of what else is going on. Unfortunately, sometimes I am Andrew Farmer. With me, co-host, life partner, yoga instructor, and producer.
All about the pants.
It's about the and single-handedly bringing back Hammer Pants. I need to applaud you for your efforts.
I'm trying to bring up the genie yoga pant.
The yogi, but see, you can't do that because it's a specific yoga.
It seems appropriate because if you're like able to do those weird twisty personal pretzel hold, then you know you literally can't touch this.
Thank you, Cole. See, I was going to go for a joke like when I go to the mall, I always stop and get a weird twisty pretzel hold. I love it when they butter it, you know, like the Auntie Anne's makes a good one. But then you had to take it to a can't touch this place, and yeah. I can't
and
make a joke that battles that.
Now you're never going to get a pretzel. So.
What number? 168? I was just talking to Cole about the fact that I listen to a lot of podcasts and actually have a recommendation for the end of the show for a podcast that reminds me a lot of this one. But this is the only podcast I know that regardless of whether it's right or wrong at the top of the show will announce the actual number of the show. I can't figure out whether that's hubris or delusions of grandeur or just our obsessive compulsive disorder, but let me solve that problem for you. You're welcome, Internet. Yeah. You're welcome.
It could be the format.
It could be the format. A lot of things can be blamed on the format, Cole.
Yeah, that's probably true.
But no stranger to format changes is our topic tonight. That was professional. That was a professional
that's
transition.
Closest you're going to get tonight.
To us being professional. Cole came at us with a brilliant idea, I think more brilliant than either of us realized at the time. Go ahead, Cole.
Well, you know, we've done many a creator spotlight, and what I will not be able to reveal to you is what number this is along those lines. I believe this is, oddly enough, only creator spotlight number 4, at best number 5.
Yeah, I think 5.
We
I think
have
unofficially
done surprisingly
5.
Few.
If you want to count the Alan Moore 5-issue creator spotlight, I think that...
the spotlight that wouldn't quit.
That's right. It was the light that wouldn't go out. It was the siren song. It was what pirates did to get, you know, ships to crash on the shore of lighthouses for this. It was, but yes, the thing about this, and Cole's going to tell you the topic in a second, is we didn't have any idea what we were getting into. It so often happens on this show. There's an idea, and it's like, okay, cool, let's give it a shot.
Yeah, this could be good for, you know, we could pad out an hour.
Yeah, we could stretch an hour out of this, and then he hits me with it. We go start doing research, and I'm like, I'm in way over my head with this. So who is the creator tonight that we are spotlighting?
Our creator tonight, if you hadn't, you know, taken a moment to even give a cursory look to the title of this.
How dare you? Cole works real hard. Real hard on that. Right. How dare you?
I work real hard on putting creator spotlight number and then a name. So that's not by you. No fancy names here or anything. Just the name of the creator themselves. But none other than Canadian superstar John Byrne.
God.
Or as we knew him when I first got into X-Men, John Byrne.
Yeah, John Byrne. That was like so many of these comics.
John
like
Byrne.
We need to do a 5-issue story arc on creators that we can't pronounce the names of. Berhovert, Byrne, Stenzewicki.
was one of the worst.
Chili Willingham.
Bill Sienkiewicz.
What is it?
Sienkiewicz.
No, it's not.
I got that from like Mike Carlin or somebody.
Sienkiewicz. Okay. Well, when we eventually do Sienkiewicz, we know.
Sipowicz.
I think that was Sipowicz, from NYPD yeah. Blue. We saw his ass a lot. I don't think we saw Sienkiewicz's ass a lot. Yes, John Byrne. Amazing. Holy hell. so much, so much. You released the Kraken on this issue of Hey Kids Comics.
I really did. I didn't realize it was like I'd gone up and smacked the beehive there, and there's a lot of bees in there.
There are. I
saw two or three buzzing around the outside, and all of a sudden there's this.
The hard part about this is where to begin, because you could easily begin with the history of John Byrne, and there's so much dating back from the early 70s in his college days. Then you also could look at things like the dichotomy of John Byrne's, where he's the conformist. You know, he did the Big Two's books. He worked within the system for so long, but the entire time he was sort of the ghost in the machine trying to affect change. You know, there's also his influence on everything.
Oh, yeah. Well, then there's like, you know, the indie burn where he kind of got his, cut his teeth on, some smaller stuff and doing some backup features in, where he created Raj 2000, depending
Stinswick. On Stinswick.
The Sienkiewicz 2000.
The Sienkiewicz 2000. Come. Enjoy the Sienkiewicz 2000.
But it was a backup story in E-Man,
mm-hmm.
which is a curious title that ran for years and years and years, and no one's ever heard of it.
I had a passing knowledge of it, but nothing. It was one of those things I would see like on Sundays at a convention when I'm flipping through looking for deals. I would see it occasionally, but that was about the best I would get.
And if you get a chance to actually, you know, track one down, a few of those down. For a while there, when we had some E-Mans, and I remember seeing the little feature in the back, and Byrne actually illustrated at least one, if not more, of their Hostess Cupcake parodies, or their Hostess Snack Cake comic ad parodies.
Oh, really?
Yeah, where they would have, it was Mostest.
Mostest? We're going to have Mostest,
because they're the Mostest.
We'll have to find those for the...
Oh, yes. I'll have to see if I can track some of it, because they were absolutely hilarious. Just wonderful little parodies of those where, the hero would come and throw snack cakes and save the day.
And he did. He started as a... He started with Carlton, I believe, didn't he?
Charlton.
Charlatan? I will continue this 200. I will continue this to issue 200. Anytime we have to talk about this comic company, I will screw up the name on purpose.
I think so. You just
the first time you would give me no end of rash of shit for calling it Charlatan Comics.
That's right.
But
comics or whatever you want.
That was his big entree into comics, I believe, because he started in college doing a couple things. And it wasn't until then that he really, I think, got his break in. Am I not right?
Yeah, it seems to be that kind of opened the doors. There was he'd created the Doomsday Plus One during his college years as well, which is one of those things that keeps the Doomsday Plus One is the series he will never let die. keeps finding new incarnations and new publishers. It's like the Brigadoon of comics.
You know what's really interesting? It just shows up.
Yeah. Just, you're going to the comic shop, 30 years after you've first encountered some incarnation. You're like, good God, what? It's another?
And you know what's really funny is that I'm noticing a lot during my research that I can draw a lot of direct lines between John Byrne and Cole Houston. He's got his pet project that he swears to the end of the earth it's going to be with him until he's done. But he's also this weird dichotomy of character, really interesting guy, great big heart. We'll fight for what he believes is right. There's a lot of Cole Houston in John Byrne, I think.
Or vice versa, because he probably got started a little earlier than I did.
And, I think the correct answer to that
and
is...
more successfully.
Would he like to have a little Cole Houston in him? And the answer is probably yes.
Why not?
Why not? But no, the other...
Indeed, who wouldn't?
The other interesting thing that happened when he was in college, which, by the way, Calgary, the most polite of big cities, he created a prototype, a xenotype for Snowbird in his college newspaper. So the Snowbird
would
eventually become Snowbird of the Alpha Flight was his one of his first published prototype characters, along with a character, and I didn't come up with the character's name, but for the sake of transparency, Gay Guy.
Yeah.
He did make a guy named Gay Guy.
Which is apparently just parodying the supposition that all art students were gay.
Right, which he was one of, by the way. We shouldn't... So this was a self-effacing parody of John Byrne. So after that, where does he go after college? Well,
by the early 70s, and certainly... or by the late 70s, rather, and into the 80s. By 79, he's already working. 78 or 79, he has landed at Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he'd been doing a lot of stuff for Charlton. And
make sure you enunciate.
For Carlisle, for Carvel
for
Crunchies.
For Carlisle. Robert Carlisle.
Yeah, for Carvel Crunchies with Cookie Puss. He had done the... he somehow winds up on the coveted X-Men title, which then becomes Uncanny X-Men. Dave Cockrum had left. It was gone from the series. And it's, to me, you know, with all due respect to the late Dave Cockrum, it's day and night.
It is.
When Byrne comes on, this thing suddenly catches fire because he's bringing so much depth to these characters visually.
And the other part to that is, Byrne has been known, and I guess it's time to talk about this because this is going to be a running thread throughout the entire issue, is one thing that he does, he loves books with he loves team books. He loves ensemble books. And he's said in interviews that the reason that he likes doing that is twofold. Number one, because he likes to attach himself to one character and really make that character the strongest character in the book. And he'll also often attach himself to what is viewed as the weakest character and try to build that character because he believes in the, and I believe it was Kirby that believed this as well, that went on record as saying it, as there are no bad characters, only bad writers. So he's a very strong narrative creator that will always attach himself to attach himself to ensemble books and build this one character up, the whole team, but he'll attack this one character and try to really flesh him out.
And I think that you had a wonderful creative pairing with Chris Claremont and John Byrne. I for the longest
Early
I was
on,
sort
yes.
of working under the assumption that they were, you know, artist and writer, never the twain shall meet. And it turns out that Byrne, as the writer, was even he's credited often as a co-plotter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that ultimately in comics, the writing comes down to a lot of the nitty-gritty, like what a character says. But there's a lot of you can tell when Byrne leaves.
Well, there's world building, and I think Byrne does world building very well, especially if you look at the litany of who he's created and what he's done, which is insane. I think that what he does better than most is build the world. There, anybody, you know, not anybody can do this, but a lot of people can write script. It takes a very special creative force to be able to build a world for these characters to live in. I think he did that very well.
And he also, you know, has this, I think left to his own devices, he can be quite a remarkable writer. It seems sometimes that what his downfall is often sort of like kind of giving into, you know, being this sort of like, sure, honey, I'll do that.
Right.
You know, some of the worst characters in Byrne, like especially in Alpha Flight and such, were characters that his wife suggested.
We've talked about him before, but what was the name of...
The absolute worst character was when he was writing The Thing, and I don't know which of the Byrnes was responsible for Goodetitious.
Yeah, right.
The giant Norseman with... a special pair of shoes that would In a way, I think looking back on it, what he was doing was sort of a modern telling of the giant whose name escapes me, encountered by Heracles.
Oh yes,
you know, this champion who was a son of Gaia. So as long as his feet remained on the earth, he was unmovable and unstoppable. And so Heracles combined brains and brawn in a rare synergy of the ancient world and just picked the guy up. So essentially what Two-Shoes' fate is to be sort of smacked out of his own shoes.
I really like the fact that you can't say Two-Shoes except for that way. You tried real hard, but you picked it up at the end.
I think it's because when I first encountered that issue, that was literally, that's where I broke company with the thing. I was actually reading it as Goody Two-Shoes.
Right.
I was talking to my friend Steve. I said, "Did you see this comic? Byrne has gone too far with Goody Two Shoes," and so it was sort of a Metereater Lad kind of thing.
Kind of situation,
yeah. Where he's like, "No, that's Goody Two Shoes." Like, you know, like I didn't make the connection. It was this. I had the same thing with the Alpha Flight character Smart Aleck. Somehow the two words were so alien to one another. It was like trying to put magnets polarized against one another. And I just never made... Oh, Smart Aleck. Like, oh, Goody Two Shoes. And then I just... Because it was like the Nordic Kip's Big Boy there. This Scandinavian... the only thing he was missing was a platter and a hamburger, which would later be given to us in the form of Big Belly Burger, which Byrne created for the Superman titles.
Yeah, he did, didn't he?
Actually made it into Arrow.
Yeah, and The Flash, for that matter. Yeah. It's good for them. Good for them.
For borrowing from what they, you know, what DC now owns. But, yeah, it immediately just sort of became good. It's just... apologies to everyone above the Timberline.
I think at some point, Byrne just gets... I think it's twofold. I think number one, because if you look at him, he's prolific as all hell. He's never not worked. From the early 70s to now, he's always plotted, always written, always drawn. He's always, even now, if you read recent interviews, everybody's asked him where he's been. He said, "I'm still working. I'm just, these books don't come out." You know, yes, the way it doesn't work in real life is, you know, the issue that you're seeing in front of you that month was not done like 3 weeks before that. It was done a year before that. You know, we're getting pages.
This isn't like South Park.
Right, exactly. They aren't doing this the night before and uploading it somewhere. This is, you know, these are plotted out. He's like, "I'm working on three different books right now, but they're not going to come out for a year, year and a half." But I think number one, he likes to take risks. I think, and number, so he'll take a character and take it in a different direction as long as he feels it's true to the character. And number two, I think he gets bored. And I think he has a lot of free reign because he's John Byrne to do whatever he wants. Especially if you read the stories of what happened under Shooter, some of my favorite stories in the world. John Byrne would go into Shooter's office and say, "Hey," like how he got on the Hulk was he went into Shooter's office and sat down and said, "Hey, I got these ideas for the Hulk. Here they are." And Shooter's like, "Well, I can't tell you what to do, but I'm gonna tell you to do whatever you can to get on that book." And I can just imagine him like nailing a rail of coke before that, you know, like Wolf of Wall Street style.
He's like, going in there bashing the head of the Hulk editor in the corner of his desk, saying, "Have you considered John Byrne?"
Right, just frame like Nick Cage style. Is that what he's doing?
Sort of like, and then, you know, it's the guy's there clutching his head and wondering if he has a concussion. He says, Shooter shrugs his shoulders and walks out. He's like, "Just saying."
Or frames him for something. The cops come and pull him out of the bullpen, and he kind of winks and finger guns at Shooter. And Shooter's like, "I never told him to do that. What the hell is going on here?" Yeah, Grunwald wasn't supposed to go to prison.
It's like the, you know, the ancient kings. You know, the guy would show up with the head of an enemy, you know, holding it by the hair. It's like, you know, just on the nod. That's what I like to see.
Well, one of the
giant... I didn't actually order his execution, but it just kind of happened.
It just kind of, I don't know, Tony Soprano. I think the one that, you know, because he did work a lot on the X-Men. He worked on Days of Future Past, which a lot of people are going to tell you is the best X-Men book ever to come out. But one of his biggest, and the one I think that I want to talk about a little bit, was a choice that he made after, when he worked for DC, because he worked for DC, worked on Wonder Woman, which was brilliant. His work on Wonder Woman is second to none. But his work, which was controversial, but I think in the end, it's one of those rare ones that's controversial, but everybody kind of agrees that it works, was his work on Superman.
Yeah, absolutely. I think because he was given... you know, a task that was simultaneously enviable and unenviable.
Right.
Because it was enviable, like, you get to recreate, you get to retool, reimagine Superman. And at the same time, sort of like, you're going to reimagine Superman? You know? And that was one of those cases where he very much understood what needed to happen to bring Superman into the modern era.
Right.
And one of the things he did was not only, you know, he tweaked the origin and tweaked some aspects of things, but one of the smartest things he did was say, you know what's wrong with Lex Luthor? Everything.
Right, right.
You know, the mad scientist angle may have played in the 30s, but we're a little more sophisticated. It's harder. I don't think we realized that it was getting increasingly harder to accept a super science Lex Luthor.
Right.
And a modern Superman needed a modern foil. He needed a nemesis who had a reason to want to destroy him other than, you know, hair loss.
Exactly, other than the fact that he stopped them from stealing a bunch of pies in a Hostess ad.
Those pies would have been mine.
No, but you're absolutely
and
right.
And
But you're absolutely right, because after Crisis...
Just the crushed ones at the bottom I would give to Otis.
Stupid Otis. It's Otis and Snaggletooth Hunchback fighting over the ones on the bottom.
That's right.
There's a mental image for you. just like two pigs under a blanket just rolling around. Why did I go Sling Blade? I'm a kind of Sling Blade. Two pigs under a blanket rolling around there to host this case. But no, he not only did he take Luther and update him, he also gave him the idea. It was born out of Byrne. That Luther didn't, that hated Superman because Superman was holding humanity back.
Yeah.
Which has carried through to the movies, has carried through to everything today. It's brilliant. And it's given us the major, the Doctor Doom of the DC universe that we know today.
They gave him a very sensible start. And from that, it opened doors for others to carry through. And the other thing Byrne did very well is pay reverence in both the Man of Steel miniseries and his later work on Superman to a long history. And I don't remember, I don't think it was one of Byrne's own works, but maybe somebody else's, where effectively there were little nods, like, you know, to the Hall of Shame. And they said, and that's something that DC has done brilliantly in the years since the Crisis. The Crisis introduced everybody to the good, the bad, the ugly. And then it allowed writers to say, let's take these ridiculous concepts and try to find a way to make them either make sense or at least work. So you got Titano as a tragic story instead of a buffoony,
bombastical,
King Kong wannabe. I don't think it was Byrne again, but somebody actually even found a way to pay homage to Turtle Boy Olsen from in a Titano's Pizza commercial. And I love the fact, because they had basically Jimmy Olsen playing this character in this ad where he's this giant. He's wearing this big Turtle Boy suit, and it is exactly the same look that the 40s or 50s Turtle Boy story had him look like.
Right.
And except that it's just this costume. I thought, what a great way to pay homage. The handful of Superman fans or people who just know things, I knew it solely because Fred Hembeck, who used to do, you know, parody Marvel, DC, and everybody,
yeah,
had done an art piece that was the many faces of Jimmy Olsen, and that was one of them. As was Elastic Lad. I think he, even the Elastic Lad concept got to see the light of day.
And something that burned, and speaking to that, and you know what he was allowed to do after Crisis, and what he was allowed to do with Superman. We talk a lot at this point about Grant Morrison and his Batman runs, and how he would dig through the errata and the real kind of nucleus of Batman and pull out things and try to tie things together and make them work and bind loose ends and really, you know, give a reason for a lot of what happened in Batman's, you know, history to exist.
Yes.
Oh, okay, well that's why, you know, Thomas Wayne was, you know, blah 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 and El Mariachi and you know, Knight and Squire. But before any of that, you had guys like Byrne, and if you look at any of the work that he's done on any of these books, not only did he shake up a lot of things, sometimes for better and sometimes for worse, but if you look at like his run on Iron Man, at the time, you didn't have Mandarin as any kind of villain in any kind of real way. Because we were going through the whole technology stint at that point, where everybody was stealing Iron Man's armor, and then Iron Man would steal back his armor. You know, that was like every issue was somebody stole, like, the Unicorn, or...
Yeah, it's like, you know, the sort of a microcosm of what would become Taken.
Right? It was just every issue was, I don't know where you are, I don't know who, but you have my armor, and it's just like, stop it.
I have a particular set of armors.
I have a particular... That needs to happen. That needs to happen.
Iron Taken.
If anybody's listening, that needs to happen. Hunter, I'm looking at you. I know you're going to hear this, but... The issues that he ran for Iron Man, he brought back Fin Fang Foom, in a time when we were straight technology, brought back a giant Kirby dragon to wander the Earth and let Iron Man fight it. He brought back the Mandarin as a villain to fight. Like, he would dig through...
He just reminded us that technological Iron Man used to have magical villains.
Right, right. And they were good villains, and they were well thought out and multifaceted, and you use them well, and you get a good story out of it, and that's what he gave us. Another thing that I know Cole absolutely loves, and so do I, is that is that Byrne has a mat on for She-Hulk.
Oh yeah,
like a mat on.
I don't know. You know, She-Hulk started out in the old torn rags. That was her costume. She apparently dressed as a nurse, even though she was a lawyer.
Right?
And then, I guess, I don't know, maybe there was, like, discount nurse suits.
And she would just go into the Scrubs place, like...
Yeah, the Scrubs must have been cheap before back then, because she would always dress in, like, the same frocks, and then they would all get torn up. She'd go get another. But, yeah, what Byrne did was realize that the Fantastic Four roster used to change from time to time. Others would come in and like, kind of be substitute.
Yeah.
You know, there can be only four, but they don't have to be the same four all the time. And what Byrne introduced with that was also he plays with ideas that no one had ever really considered. Like, you know, once Franklin comes along... Is the Baxter Building really a proper home?
For a child, yes.
Something like that. I mean, it's like, you know, they're living in effectively the superhero version of the Jefferson's apartment complex. I don't remember a single kid there.
That is a great analogy. That is a Cole analogy right there. That he also screwed us over in about the biggest way possible.
The tragic accident where... Thing walked on that British guy's back. course, they're still scraping bits of him out of
the damn it. Damn it, Cole. No, but he gave us the fanboy heartbreak that was Alicia Masters running off with Johnny Storm and the thing saying cheese it and putting on his trench coat and going out and finding the Yancey Street gang to hang out with for a while.
Have his Yancey Street depression moment again.
Yeah, but that did allow us to have She-Hulk
deal with depression. He goes and yanks that Yancey Street and 7th light pole down.
Yep.
I mean, it's kind of the point where the city installed a shed right there. So just go get another one, put it up.
There's a guy on call 24/7. That's right.
There's a sign there, 310 days since the last Yancey Street sign wrangling. But, go back and change it to zero again.
But that allowed us, him walking off was a great entree to allow, like you were saying, the revolution into the team of She-Hulk, and not in her scrubs this time around.
Yeah, and frankly, you know, for my money, she never looked sexier than in a Fantastic Four costume.
You don't think?
There's some sexy.
Where's that pirate costume that everybody talks about? The one.
Oh, there was that Avengers.
Yeah, there was that Avengers.
Arabian Nights, designed by none other than Janet Van Dyne herself.
She's got issues. Somebody really needs to sit her down and have a conversation.
Let She-Hulk tear her work off, even though that particular size of that particular design. I don't think there are many models that could have worn that.
Right, and she just kind of goes, oh boy, like, oh dang.
I guess they were just going to take it in, you know.
Right, all the way in.
Once, and then they're going to take it about 6 yards of cloth.
All the way in. They were going to take it completely in.
That's right. I mean, they could pick like 3 suits out of the one that
That's right. Well, we got the material. Let's use it to build the roof for the shed that we have to put on Yancey Street and 7th.
But they, I'm sure there'll be people who went and checked and like, no, that wasn't Yancey and 7th. It was
right.
Something else.
And to those people, I say, shut up.
In this particular case, that's the one he grabbed. So, no, Yancey doesn't even cross 7th. Shut up! But bringing She-Hulk in was brilliant because she was available within the context. Nobody was really utilizing She-Hulk per se.
Right.
She didn't have her own title anymore or anything like that. And it gave you a bruiser-type character who was a different, you know, super strong character. She filled the necessary power gap.
Right.
But with a whole different kind of dynamic. Where you didn't have the kind of the buddy picture playful rivalry with Johnny Storm.
Right. It balanced the team, too, when it came to the feminine versus the masculine, even though, you know, she often was the bruiser. It was a really interesting dichotomy in the sense that she was the bruiser, but also probably the most feminine, the most actively... you know, feminine character on the team, because it's not till later in Byrne's run that he renames Invisible Girl Invisible Woman.
Exactly.
Which he did as well.
And the thing about it is, that's an example of one thing I wanted to talk about during his run on Fantastic Four, is one of the things Byrne does well is look at characters and say, you know, has anybody really thought about these characters? Most of them just sort of are willed into existence. They go about their business. They do their thing based on their particular power set. And occasionally someone, you know, humanizes them or characterizes them. Byrne goes in and says, well, hey, you know, we know that this character does this. Like, for some reason, Gladiator from the Imperial Guard of Shi'ar got an advanced copy that fell through a wormhole from the future of what was it? Not Civil War, but the invasion or
the secret Skrull. Invasion. Yeah,
secret invasion. Yeah, so he thought that the Fantastic Four were Skrulls,
right? For some reason,
which were actually the actual Skrulls. You know, decades before were remanded to go. Live as cows in upstate New York, but that's a different story.
Right.
Which they didn't live long because you know, Reed Richards, sometimes in his scientific hubris, he may have been able to strip them of their ability to ever change again, but what he didn't work out was that, you know, in a sort of H.G. Wellsian way, their big downfall was they're highly allergic to earth grass, and they all asphyxiated.
Poor Skrulls.
Yeah.
Also, didn't...
And a lot of people got sick from eating Skrull meat.
Gross. Also, you know, doesn't take into account the fact that the worst torture the human that anyone can ever imagine is being trapped inside your own mind in the body of a cow.
Exactly.
For 50 years.
Was a bad scene.
just cow trapped, which is the name of a book that I'm writing.
I just want to go on record and say I feel that Reed Richards is guilty of Skrull slaughter.
I think Reed Richards is guilty of Skrull rendition. I think that he should be played by Brad Pitt in the upcoming movie. and I hope those emails never get out.
But one of the things he did with Gladiator coming and deciding that they were Skrulls and coming to attack them was to redefine or actually define. This was a character who was created during Byrne's run at X-Men. And I think he realized, you know, it was, or at least was utilized, if not created, then, you know, realized that the whole Imperial Guard of Shi'ar was just a blatant Legion of Superheroes ripoff.
Sure.
And to the point where later they, you know, cemented that by making sure they had plenty. In fact, in the X-Men story, he and Claremont, one or both, bring in a few Imperial Guard of Shi'ar who are not analogs.
Well, they had to at some point, right? Yeah. Like, you run out.
Like, yeah. Hussar and Manta were not, to my knowledge, analogs of anyone. But, you know, pretty much the rest of them were often blatant. But, you know, they advanced the Superboy idea to a Superman character.
Right.
In Gladiator. And what was brilliant about that story is he decides, okay, how about we say that the reason he has all of this vast array of powers is he literally has only one power, and that's psionics. And he's able to utilize that ability in multiple ways.
Right.
And in a way, that opened a door for so many other characters to be thusly defined.
And I think pretty much at that point, every character, almost every character that had kind of that ultra skill set was defined in that way.
And it also allows, in a sense, it allows for Mr. Fantastic himself.
Mm-hmm.
Because everything about Mr. Fantastic, you know, if you've ever tried to hurl a 70-foot hose...
Oh, have I, Cole?
Blammo!
Blammo!
That's what she said!
We aren't punchy at all tonight, are we?
No, not in the least, but, you know... Gravity takes over, yet Mr. Fantastic can, swirl down the hallways. And
this is literally my favorite conversation that we've had so long.
It's the last favorite.
It's the last favorite. It literally swirls down the hallways, Cole. Literally swirls.
Literally swirls down the hallways. Most assuredly.
But no, yeah. And, you know... he's not without... That's the interesting thing, and you know, we've talked a little bit about his influence, but I don't think we've talked too much about, like, his... I don't know how to define... Like, we were talking earlier before the show, like, I think that in a lot of ways, we kind of look at him as an analog for ourselves, a certain age of comic book reader, a certain, you know, like, men of a certain age, we are definitely comic book readers of a certain age, and he's interesting because I can't figure out whether he is, you know, a prognostic, whether he's the Nostradamus of his time, and he was constantly foreseeing and preaching against these, what we're seeing now. Because he was one of the first people to come out against the speculator market. He was one of the first people to come out against what we're seeing now, which is this never-ending chain of events. Everything's got to be this event. You never have a time, especially in the big two, where you're not having Secret Wars 2 or the thing they're doing now in Marvel, where they're bringing people, a bunch of people back from the dead, or the thing, you know, any of the stuff they're doing in DC, where they're getting ready to relaunch a bunch of number ones again. You know, we're seeing this, and he was the first person to come out and say, you know, this is going to be a problem. We are going to have a problem with this. But is it that, or is it that he's, you know, that by the time he was preaching out against the things that he was seeing, and he was, you know, old enough to recognize what was going on, or was he just a crotchety, you know, did he get crotchety like we
was
do?
Was he just bitter? Yeah.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's not what I want it to be.
A combination of both. I think that, you know, as time goes on, we begin to see the how right he was.
Right, I agree.
And, you know, when you start to see the earmarks of these things, I think he was one of the few to be able to resist becoming a part of a lot of the cross-company crossovers, or the whole company crossovers in his books.
Right.
Because, you know, nothing stymied a lot of these books more than either having to work toward being a part of some upcoming event thing.
Right.
Or just having to drop everything and, you know, crowbar some sort of ridiculous notion into the middle unexpectedly of a storyline that's otherwise going places.
Well, and I think that this is, keep in mind, what I'm about to tell you is couched in the fact that he is Canadian. And he had what I can view, one of the most interesting arguments when you consider the source, internet arguments with Dan Slott. Dan Slott's the writer for Spider-Man. And Dan Slott recently did a really cool thing, in my opinion, with Spider-Man, where he took Spider-Man from being the reporter, always broke, never have any money, that struggle, to putting him in charge of a tech company. Because a lot of people often forget that Spider-Man is a super tech genius.
Yeah, exactly. Why would he stay as an underpaid freelance photographer for the rest of his life?
But after the dissolution of the Fantastic Four, Peter Parker takes over the Baxter Building and creates a tech company. And he kind of becomes the anti-Bruce Wayne. You know, the not angry Bruce Wayne. And John Byrne took issue with this, you know, that he comes out against Dan Slott and accuses him of falling in line with the current idea that change is good and we should change everything, and they proceed to have the most polite argument I've ever seen two people have in my life. But, you know, Dan Slott goes in and says, you know, and I'm going to quote directly from the argument because it was on Twitter. It you know, to be fair, Mr. Byrne, didn't a lot of your best runs at Marvel DC start with the premise that change is good? And he goes on to list Hulk and Bruce Banner separate. The conspicuous, at best, Namor becomes the mogul for Oracle Inc., if you remember that miniseries came out. The suit, the black Armani-suited Namor in a business room that everybody wanted to see. When I was a kid, I said I wanted Namor to be, you know, making deals and selling stock. You know, the Superman that we'd already talked about, the She-Hulk, which we haven't talked about yet, but the fact that we have talked about it in the past, that she was kind of one of the originators, if you don't look at Ambush Bug, of breaking the fourth wall and winking and pointing at the camera.
Absolutely.
As it were.
And deliberately so.
Yeah, and he goes on to list all these, and then John Byrne goes on to refute them and say, you know, that everything that he did had precedent. Everything that he did had come before, nothing was permanent. It was a thing that, you know, and so that's kind of the dichotomy of him was what his claim is he was kind of toting the company line when he did it. And he didn't change any of the characters, and you're changing the character, you know, and then Slott goes back in to refute that. But it is, if you can find it, it's one of the most polite arguments I've ever seen in my life where, you know,
it's like what, you know, an internet flame war ought to be like.
Right,
or it doesn't become a personal attack. It's just sort of a proper debate.
One of them, it really helps that one of them is Canadian, and I think this is very angry for John Byrne. I think this is like steamed out, angry as hell, John Byrne, and this is just as angry as he gets. Which is, I think we're going to have to agree to disagree on that point.
It's almost like, you know, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore.
But why do you? Where do you think that, this comes
that's
from?
That's the level of intensity.
Because if
that
we're
you get from John Byrne,
right? How do you think he justifies this? Because he has gone and like I said, I do think he gets bored, and he invents things that, for better or worse, are out there. Like the Great Lakes Avengers was his invention.
Yeah.
You know, the She-Hulk was his invention. The breaking the fourth wall of the She-Hulk was his invention, I should say. I don't want to get yelled at.
And what's interesting there with that dynamic is when She-Hulk would again get, you know, for the third time, as to my knowledge, again, I'm not certain here, but at least for the third time, She-Hulk gets her own title.
Right.
And they're concentrating on her, the lawyer aspect. But again, they're taking cues from Byrne and realizing this character plays very well in a humorous bent.
Right.
Rather than trying to tell serious, hardcore superhero stories where She-Hulk goes out, you know, goes from town to town, gets adventures, saves
right.
people, or, you know, but I think that in some ways, yeah, perhaps Byrne was towing the company line, but, you know, in some ways, are not these others doing likewise? I mean, they don't have free reign over these properties.
Sure,
somebody's calling the shots. And occasionally, when we get the people calling the shots who recognize the true talent and let them, you know, give them some freedoms to exercise that talent, then we get these wonderful things. And other times, you just see people who are just like, you know, whatever you say.
Right. And I think that's the beauty. And I think he understands. Because, like I said, he doesn't want the speculator's boom. He doesn't want to be a LaFeld. He doesn't want to be a Jim Lee. He doesn't want to be, you know, a Brian Bendis that goes on talk shows now. He doesn't want that recognition. What he wants is a good quality piece of art that's going to last for a while. And art is about chance a lot of times, but art is also about a style choice and reverence to what's come before it and an eye on the future. I think he's an artist when you come down to it.
Oh, absolutely. And he's one of those artists who, right, oddly enough, personally, I think he was at his height many years ago. He's slowly starting to work back in. He kind of comes and goes. Like many of his contemporaries in the day, somewhere between the mid-80s and the early 90s, the experimental style.
Oh, yes.
It's a term, and I have no doubt I've mentioned this often.
Yes.
Of Keith Giffen.
Yes.
When I first encountered Giffen's work on the Legion of Superheroes.
Right.
And it was some amazing work for its day. And then he adopted the experimental style. It was like someone else had taken over.
Right. Somebody like, else just was writing and signing his name.
I could not find anything that you could hang his, you know, that you could point to and say, oh, yeah, you can tell, you can still tell that's him. Yeah, there was nothing there. It was an entirely different person's work. And Byrne more so, you could still see that it was John Byrne. But it was just when he adopted his experimental style, you know, with all due respect to the man, experimental style in this case looked like lazy.
Right. Yeah.
Lots of shortcuts. This is also a period where it seemed like Frank Miller was either trying to be more artsy or more lazy. I'm not sure which. But it seemed like one thing that Frank Miller was doing was simplifying everything he had to draw. Oh, look, Black Widow. I know. Let's cut off all her hair and take away those gauntlets. And
so
anything,
mad.
Any aspects of her costume that require much work. All I have to do is a basic human form and a leotard with a spider on one breast. And
you're so mad. You're so mad about that one Black Widow costume.
Oh, it was about the time I discovered Black Widow, and I thought, what a sexy costume, because it kind of invoked, like, TV's Catwoman.
Yeah.
You know, with that kind of hip-hugger belt going on that just accentuated the female form. And she's got the you know, the lovely just mountain, you know, this flowing cascade of red hair. And And then all of a sudden he comes in and turns her into, you know, Susan Powder. And
Jesus, first, I think that's the first Susan Powder reference on any podcast I have ever heard in my life. Matter of fact, my brain had to, like, cycle up to remember what Susan Powder looks like. But do you think that this...
You will truly never know where
oh
I'm
my god, no, you my won't.
Analogs.
You won't. Good lord.
There's one thing I do well. Is drawing the most bizarre analogs.
I'm the best at what I do, and what I do is confuse you. No, but do you think that all this... Here's my thought is,
let me close on this whole thing because I do sound very bitter.
Oh, no,
Byrne himself has said that his work never looked better than when it was inked by Terry Austin.
Right. Right.
It was then that I realized, okay, he didn't necessarily get lazy. He just lost the best embellisher he ever had.
Right. Do you think a lot of these experimental styles, are they all roughly the same time period? In your recollection?
Yeah, there's a period where that was being bandied about. And it may still be happening. I don't know. I don't follow any artists enough to know if they suddenly abruptly stop caring. But, I mean, another good example of where I'll agree, you know, Terry Austin was a boon. But when Byrne started working on Wonder Woman, he pulled a Frank Miller.
Yes. Yes, he
because
did.
Because her little hot pants went from Star Spangled to Star Kissed, as it were.
Yeah.
They had like a couple of stars instead of 26 or whatever, you know, random number of stars there had always been.
But do you think that that was a... Okay, so here's the conclusion that I'm drawing. Here's the conspiracy theory in my brain behind this is... It's almost like an editorial mandate, because if I remember right, a lot of these experimental styles were dropping right about the same time. And a lot more books were coming out, and a lot more pressure was on these artists
churn pages. I think absolutely this was a period where the better, more popular artists were suddenly, subsequently in higher demand.
And
therefore, something had to give.
Right. Right, so you're getting this pressure from the top, telling you need to put out more. We've got more books, we've got more pages we need.
Oh yeah, so in a Scarface level haze of white powder, Byrne is told experimental style.
It looks like the cast of the Bus and Trunk live action musical Frozen is coming out of there. At any given time, just the hoo-ah is coming out of the shooter's office at all times.
Back into one of those snow plow things.
It's snow blower just right out of the office at all times. But no, that's just my line of thinking, is that all this pressure is coming down on, you know, all these guys, and they all have to put out more. You know, okay, we'll cut some corners on the art. We'll make it work. Nobody cares. And then sometime in the 90s, we start seeing this young crop of, you know, Jay Lee's, Jim Lee's, Rob Liefeld's, Mark Silvestri's, Tony Daniels, and all these guys come up, and they're drawing these very, McFarlane, I think, probably the start of this, with just very intricate, you know, putting more spider webs on Spider-Man's costume
exactly.
than have ever been there. And
I mean, no one had ever put more whorls and curly cues and filigree into the middle of a spider web than McFarlane. It just, you know, suddenly this thing not only had a texture and form, it had this sort of an artful, apparently it was sort of a spatter or something. Maybe something was jammed in the little web shooter.
Right. It's like a spirograph.
It's like that last little bit of silly string where, you know, gums up a bit.
You're on fire tonight with these analogies, man. But yeah, so I'm wondering, and then everybody went buck crazy. Everybody went next level bananas for this art that was so intricate. And then everybody's like, I have a great idea. Let's make this the art thing that happens now. Like, but you told us 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago that we couldn't do this anymore.
Yeah.
You know, well, Captain America's, you know, scale mail needs to be more scaly, and Spider-Man's, you know, it's like, oh, come on, guys.
Yeah, because Captain America started out, you know, in full scale armor, literally. Right. And then, you know, over time, it just sort of like, same with Aquaman, you know, you mm-hmm. start to get this sort of hint. It's like, you know, if you get in the right light, you can kind of see some of the scales. And they got to the point where it's just nothing, mm-hmm. you know, not even a suggestion of the scale. And then for a while there, Captain America was just bristling somewhere in the 2000s.
Like gravity had no hold on his scales.
You literally got eye injuries because you cut yourself on looking at it.
Right? People had to give him a wide berth.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, see, and that's the thing.
It was like feathers or something, only sharper and heavier.
Everything got to the point where if you read certain issues of Spawn, like, you couldn't read it. Like, you had to look away because it was too much, like, looking into the face of God. It was like, no, I can't. There's too many chains and flowing robes. I can't. I don't know what's happening. Like, I'm blind in one eye. I can see the future. I don't know what's going on now. Like that, and I think that that's my personal conspiracy theory, John Byrne notwithstanding, that this was all editorial mandate, and I think a lot more is editorial mandate than we give credit for. But we're getting up to the end of this, and I want to know how you want to end this. Like, what point do you want to end on for John Byrne?
I think with Byrne, what you have, the only thing I can say other than. He does not know how to draw children. They all look like little squashed adults. But and I think I've said that before as well. Byrne has one of those unique careers in that he's been around for, 40 years or more?
Almost 50 now, yeah.
Yeah, pretty much the entirety of my own personal comic book history.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I first discovered Byrne and the X-Men simultaneously. Somehow, I missed the Cockrum period wholesale.
Right.
And Byrne's stuff just sort of jumped off the page. And then, you know, like anybody, you know, I will gushingly talk about Alan Moore, and we have, but there are Alan Moore things that I want nothing to do with.
Right.
Some of the stuff he was doing, like the Tom Strong,
Prometheus stuff. Yeah,
Prometheus. That was all I couldn't think of. I can't get behind that. But the Byrne is one of those where, you know, there's this constant, not necessarily a love hate relationship, but a love indifference relationship, where, you know, some of his work I absolutely adore, and some of it, like,
not so much.
I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't waste the paper. Wouldn't really want to waste my eye space on.
Right.
I don't want to have any part of my brain wasted on having even the knowledge that I'd seen some of it.
But you also wouldn't come out against it.
No, not at all. And the thing, that's what I love about him, because like Moore, he is very diverse, both as a writer and an artist. He proved himself very well as a writer, which was surprising. And then when you go back and realize, you know, co-plotter was a gross understatement.
Right.
During his X-Men years. I think he, in many ways, didn't necessarily carry Claremont, but enhanced and strengthened and supported Claremont in many ways. And it's also important to point out that his body of work is all over the map, from little his own personal projects like Babe, or which has nothing to do with Sheep, Pretty Pigs, to you know, the, what was the one? It was kind of like Doomsday Plus One. He had this, and he's brought it back. There was like this superhero ensemble group.
It wasn't Danger Unlimited, was it?
That was it, yeah. Danger Unlimited, which came back. And then even did a thing for one of the indies, like IDW or whoever had the Star Trek license at the time.
Oh, that's right.
It was a Dr. McCoy intergalactic physician, or so I can't remember the precise title. I saw the first issue, which was brilliant. I found out later that you know, it kind of told its own story, but it didn't go back, and, you know, there was no, it was sort of an anthology. There were just, each issue was a different story, but it was so cool because he understood the character of Dr. McCoy and told a story that fit in the time period of around the first movie.
Right.
In fact, he portrays McCoy with a giant bushy beard.
Which is awesome. Which I hope Carl Urban decides to adopt for the next Star Trek movie. Indeed.
And the other thing that's so cool about when he does licensed stuff, he understands the characters that he's writing. He immerses his version of the character in the character you know. And that's the same thing he did during his precisely 2-issue stint on The Adventures of Indiana Jones. And the story he told in those 2 issues plays very well as an Indiana Jones story.
Right.
And then he left because he got tired of the meddling, not of the editorial mandates at Marvel, but the editorial mandates coming from from Lucasfilm.
I don't doubt it. I don't doubt it.
They actually had a person from Lucasfilm there scrutinizing the minutiae of every issue and asking questions and making demands. And, you know, he would bring something. He talks about having, you know, certain things that were in those issues he did. And this person saying, well, why didn't you, you know, do some coverage of this? Like, you know, Vinny talks about that. I said, and he was telling me, did you even watch the movie? It would be like if, you know, they're talking about his past with Abner, if they took time out to do a flashback.
Right, right.
You wouldn't do that.
And he understands the medium, too. That's the other thing, is that he understands what he can do here with a license that you can't do on the screen.
Well, he also thinks through his characters. Like, back when Alpha Flight was coming out, there was, you know, it was back in the days when there were comic book magazines that didn't rely on fart jokes and telling you your collection was going to put your kids to college to sell.
Right.
Comics Interview and Amazing, was it Amazing Comics or something like that, you know, actually were journalistic comic book magazines. And I remember reading Burns' interview about Alpha Flight and how he took what I would later find out, a collection of characters he despised being forced to create.
Right, absolutely.
And showed them some love. And the new characters that he added, like Marina, the concepts were kind of clever, where he was thinking about the culture of parts of Canada and deliberately making, you know, working some of those things in. I've talked to Canadians, actual real life.
They exist?
French speaking Canadians, by the way.
What?
Who have no earthly idea what Sapristi is. If you go and look at Alpha Flight or a lot of other Burn stuff, Sapristi is, no one seems to know what that is, and apparently no one in Canada has ever said Sacre Bleu.
I don't believe that's true. I'm pretty sure someone has at some point.
Well, other than Burn.
Other than Burn, yeah, he was the only one.
Apparently there's no translation, there's no such word as Sapristi.
I love the fact that Burn is the Canadian writer, so they give him Alpha Flight. Like, that had to be, like... and he was young enough, too, and new enough to the business. He's like, yeah, I can... okay.
You're like the Doug and Bob McKenzie of Marvel. Can you do some... Great White... How about this? We get, like, Thor in Canada and call it Great White Norse. I actually stole that from something in the past.
That's hilarious. But, you're absolutely right. But...
So, I mean, in... Even though he hated the characters, it's like, thank God we didn't get, like, the Mountie or...
Till later.
Or the Goose.
The Goose. I would have loved for that to have been a super villain. I hate Canadian geese. They're the bane of my existence. One bit me on the balls when I was 3, and I've never been the same since.
Oddly enough, I was bitter about some John Byrne and especially... Frank Miller stuff as you are about being your testicles goosed.
Literally, that's where it comes from. Is the Canadian geese have laser-like focus on male genitalia, and they will take it out.
They're worse than those fish, those little catfish in the Amazon. We don't need to invoke those.
No, because I have nightmares.
Urethra secret.
No, goddamn, come on. Nobody needs to think about a catfish in their pee hole. No one. There's a person on the face of this earth that needs to be like, you know what?
Nothing worse than a fish that has backward facing spikes on its fins.
I'm going to spend the next 30 seconds thinking about a catfish swimming up my pee hole. No. No, no, no. Line drawn. No pee hole catfish.
A more pleasant note. Closing thoughts on Burns.
Right. For me, there's a quote from an article, and that article is in Comic Book Resources. And I implore you to go read it. It's called John Byrne, The Hidden Answers. Brilliant article. So much revealed about the character of the man. And integral to the research that we did here tonight, more than I ever knew. I mean, we would have sat here and talked about the way he drew Colossus's butt for an hour if it wasn't for stuff like this. But there's a quote in this that I can't figure out whether it came from Cole or from John Byrne, but it's attributed to John Byrne, so I'm going to give it to him. And it goes a little something like this.
Well, there's also no corollary drawn between whatever he's talking about and some obscure pop culture reference.
Yeah, it doesn't say anything about
Alf. So it definitely couldn't have come from me.
It doesn't say anything about Vicky from Small Wonder in here. I've got to imagine this is John Byrne. It says, as long as new blood is making a conscious decision to walk into comic book shops looking for comics, and as long as the comics that we produce continue to be aimed at the wrong audience, the industry has slim hope of recovery or even survival. And I think that quote sums up John Byrne's through the ages. And keep in mind, he's worked in four different comic book ages at this point, as we quantify them, more than anything. And that is that we need to make good books with good narratives. And he's always done that, or at least attempted to do that and tell a story. And that's, I think, what we've lost focus on as an industry. Is that we have like Civil War One, Civil War Two, Secret Wars.
Well, it's
Wars
like
I.
Okay, what well can we draw from anew?
Right.
How about I don't know digging new wells.
Right. How about we fire the Thing, put She-Hulk on the team, just call her Wonder or call her Invisible Woman. Let's get him out of the Baxter Building and tell a new story with these fantastic characters that were created, you know, 40-odd years or 50-odd years before I touch them, and they'll be around for another 50. Instead of that, let's go back to the Beyonder shows up with an afro and roller skates. And, you know, stop it. You know, stop it.
Well, the problem that we're running into is, in many ways, the comic industry is becoming Hollywood about 10 or 15 years ago.
That's true. No, you're right.
And they're starting to do this again, and what do you do when you're pressed, just do a remake? And Hollywood continues to do that in fits and starts. Let's do Rollerball or RoboCop or another R movie. Another movie that starts with R.
Or Rollerball again, but this time with old James Caan in it.
And, you know, and in many ways, I have less issue with an all-female Ghostbusters than I have with a Ghostbusters needing to be, you know, re-examined in that way.
Right. I think, honestly, and this is going to be a controversial point, I have less issue with the female Ghostbusters than I do with rolling in, you know, and no offense to Dan Aykroyd, but fat Dan Aykroyd, apathetic Bill Murray, and crazy the guy who played Winston Zeddemore, I can't remember his actual name.
Oh, Ernie Hudson.
Yeah, crazy Ernie Hudson, propping them up in front of a thing and slapping a proton pack on them at like 55, 60 years old. Like, I have way more of a problem with that than I do with a new cast. Way more of a problem.
But it's just like, you know, these things became iconic. The things that became iconic in film or comics became iconic because they were new. And, you know, we don't need a Kingdom Come 2. We don't need a Marvels 2. Those things spoke to us as readers because they were new and unique.
Right.
Whereas Secret Wars, ironically, apparently is better in its new incarnation because the original didn't speak to anybody.
I'm not real sure. If this one speaks to one person, then it's out ahead of the game.
Yeah. But, I, you know, conceptually, I like the idea of drawing from all of the different Marvel things that, you know, different aspects of Marvel and different eras and different worlds and stuff, far more than the, you know, of any sort of reboots. That seems to be the most sensible, instead of just sort of like, oh, let's tell the same old story in a new way.
Right. All right. All right. Let's wrap it up. We are long, so we should probably wrap it up. Thank you guys for listening to us opine about John Byrne for
yes,
an hour.
Indeed.
It's one of those things that we didn't know we were as passionate about until we actually got into this the source material and started really digging around in his life and realized how close he runs an analog for a lot of comic book fans out there. So thank you, John Byrne, for your work. I think that's
for being both a creator and a fan, and
that's true.
That's kind of unique.
So, Cole, do you have any final thoughts on John Byrne?
I think that I would say in closing, go and seek out John Byrne's work as mm-hmm. writer, as artist. Discover this talent. If you're following anything currently, go back and look at some of the stuff early in the career and see, you know, where some things, aspects of his career got better, some changed drastically. There were periods where it's kind of a little lackluster, but for the most part, you know, explore this amazing career, because when you have a career creator, especially with the body of work he has, you're going to find a lot of different things that he's done that you never would have imagined. And that's one of the things we try to do with the Creator Spotlight, is choose creators who are not just famous, but have a body of work and have a number of different approaches they've taken to their to the creative process that allow you to, regardless of your taste, find something out there.
Right. And I think you hit on a very valid point, that if you're any book you might be reading, if it's a legacy comic book, John Byrne is touched in some way. So go back and find his work, whether it be the Avengers, whether it be Spider-Man, whether it be Wonder Woman, whether it be the Justice League, whether it be the Legion, whatever it is, he's had a hand in it somewhere down the line. Go back and find his work and read it. I guarantee you, you'll be surprised, if not pleasantly, at what he did with the source material. I think that's it, I think. I think we've done John Byrne some bit of justice tonight.
Absolutely.
So why don't you plug us up, and we will roll out of here into this good night and come back next week and gee-jaw more about some other stuff.
Absolutely. Well, this is, of course, Hey Kids Comics comes to you from the Jedi Cole universe, JediCole.com. Please feel free to write to us at jcumail@yahoo.com. If you, you also... occasional tweets still happening from our Twitter account, which is at the Jedi Cole Universe, at the Jedi Cole U, excuse me. And of course, my project of personal passion for now going into year 4, Convention Awareness Project Texas at cap-tx.info, where I'm giving you a resource to find every convention in the state of Texas all year long. I will be at LubbockCon in Lubbock, Texas in February. You can find the date and the website on the Cap Texas site. And, of course, in March, we haven't talked about it much yet this year. AllCon 2016 is coming up, year 12 Oof. Of AllCon, speaking of legacies. And my 12th year of involvement, Games in Theory, is going gangbusters. If you can get out to AllCon, please, I implore you, need to check this out if you've never been. Thursday is free of charge all day long. We have a full slate of programming going on. And the game show track has its own committed room, one stop for every game show.
That's amazing.
Which is
that's just huge.
Been incredible.
That's a huge boon for everyone involved.
Yeah, some brand new shows, a lot of amazing talent coming out, a lot of new producers this year. Game shows is really coming of its own now. This is the 11th year of game show content at AllCon, and a record banner year for the sheer volume of titles of shows. I want to say a special thank you to Matt from SCNS Live, who is going to be our surrogate Andrew for onliners, so that does not have to go away.
Yes, yes.
And I can maintain my my place as the Tom Lennon onliners.
And you do it so well.
Yes, indeed. And so we got some great games and some stuff that didn't get used last year, and a brand new just semantics. There's just come to AllCon. There's over 400 different things going on over 4 days. You can't do it all. And of course, because yet again, I'm only too happy to bribe you to come to my show. Some of the other participants will also be eligible here. But if you come to certain shows, all of my game shows and panels, you can get your raffle tickets at the end of the weekend on Sunday. We give away this year's grand prize.
Ooh, grand prize! They've been awesome so far, so I can only imagine what this year's
going to be
like. I
have lost track. I think this is 6 years of grand prizes.
It's insane.
6 or 7 years now. So, anyway, I will gush more about AllCon as time goes on. And in fact, this is as good a time as any to mention. I will be gone for about 4 to 5 weeks as I wrap up my preparations for AllCon, and AllCon itself happens. There's going to be less and less time. So Andrew's going to be bringing in a whole slate of guests and some amazing new stuff that I look forward to listening to myself when I have time.
Well, it's not like I'm going to let you be a part of this, away from this, apart,
oh, yeah,
one word, not two, from this from too long. So expect everything that I do to be vetted through my producer. In the hive mind, but yeah, so AllCon's going to be awesome this year. If you have the opportunity, if you're in the area, I can tell you it is my favorite convention, and I am a convention whore. I go to all of them, and this one by far has been my favorite. So yeah, join us next week for more Hey Kids Comics. We're going to have another hour coming to you. And I said then at the top of the show that I was going to plug something we don't usually do, but there's a particular podcast that I've been listening to that's actually excellent, and if you guys like this podcast, I think you'll like that one too. It's called Last Podcast on the Left, and it's a comedy horror podcast, and they do a very similar thing that we do with comics, but they do it with a grand sweeping horror thing. Very funny, very informative. So if you get a chance to listen to it. Completely separate plug. They are in no way associated with the Jedi Cole universe, which has a whole slew of its own amazing shows that you have obviously already listened to. But that one as well. There's only so many, you know, there's a lot of hours in the day. You're going to run out of podcasts at some point. That's a good one to listen to. So join us again next week for Hey Kids Comics. Listen to all the Jedi Cole universe. Get out there, buy, collect, and enjoy your comics, especially John Byrne comics. There's some amazing ones out there to check out. I think that's all I got. Say goodnight, Cole.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody, and we'll check in next week for more Hey Kids.
gay, deceive and look away.